writer's voice. To celebrate our 30 years of on-air service, Virginia Voice's Patty Campbell talks to noted writers about their lives and work.
Welcome to The Writer's Voice. I'm Patty Campbell, your host for this program, and today we welcome Times Dispatch columnist Jeff Shapiro. Jeff, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
We're very excited about your being here. I have a question for you right off the top. For a long time, you were a reporter who covered state government. Now, as a columnist, you frequently write about state government. I'm interested in the difference in approach, and by way of that, the difference between being a reporter and a columnist.
Well, actually, I'm still both a reporter and a columnist. I guess I would argue neither fish nor fowl. And as a result, it really kind of colors the way I fulfill these dual, sometimes conflicting roles. So particularly as a columnist, I try not to be, if you will, argumentative, which is, I think, a trait so often associated with columnists. Writing on government and politics, I instead try to offer kind of context. Use the column more as a reporting vehicle than an opportunity, as many columnists might, to kind of ball one's fist and beat one's chest. So until I am firmly on one track or the other, I have to kind of carefully exist somewhere in between.
Do you enjoy the careful existence?
Oh, I do. And there are little things that I do to try to function in that middle ground. I rarely, for example, write in the first person. I try to emphasize reporting as opposed to the argumentative. It seems to me that if one is offering context, the long view on an issue or personalities, that ultimately the reporting supports that.
Okay. Well, let's hear something from your writing.
Well, some of the things I write are maybe a little lighter in that they deal with serious subjects, but they try to do so maybe with tongue planted firmly in cheek. So here's something I wrote a couple of summers ago while the legislature was struggling again, it seems, with the budget and transportation finance. The scene these days at the Republican-controlled state capitol recalls an enduring summer tableau. Cockroaches scurrying for cover when you turn on the light. The majority party is facing a voter revolt over stiff new financial penalties for lousy drivers. Republicans have succeeded not only in enraging their conservative base, but everyone else by agreeing with Democratic Governor Tim Kaine to impose the penalties only on Virginians. Groucho Marx, as wacky dictator Rufus T. Firefly in the comedy film Duck Soup, had an easier time of it ruling fictional Fredonia than Bill Howell and Walter Stosch have running the House and Senate GOP caucuses. These days, Republicans, retreating on those fees because they're seen as an unfair, clever-by-half breach of their no-new-taxes pledge, are living by one of Marx's great maxims. Those are my principles, and if you don't like them, well, I have others. One Republican delegate is in court, suing to have the entire transportation finance package, of which the fees are a minuscule part, thrown out. Others, holding away their handiwork as if it were a wailing baby in a smelly diaper, want a special session to repeal the fees. Democrats are anything but innocent. Many of them backed the four-figure penalties and are professing ignorance of their only in Virginia application. Kaine's obsequious suck-up to Howell and Stosch spotlights the disconnect between a governor who has to work with Republicans and Democrats trying to defeat them this fall. Perhaps Democrats can more easily distance themselves from Kaine because his name is not on the ballot. That means he is less of a target for Republicans desperate for a diversion. As the ruling party of the General Assembly, Republicans have the most to lose. The problem is one of substance and salesmanship. the debate over fees calls attention to their frailty, if not fatuousness, as a revenue source for roads and rail. Does anyone actually still believe the penalties can squeeze the projected $65 million a year just from irresponsible Virginia motorists? Certainly not when local courts, controlled, by the way, by the Republican majority, are rejecting the penalties as unconstitutional. A gas tax increase may seem a common-sense solution because it would be easy to administer, and everyone, Virginian and non-Virginian, would pay it. But if some Republicans are flailing in made-to-order districts because of the fee flap, they would be finished off by a tax increase. This speaks to the isolation caused by computer-driven partisan redistricting. Republicans are pushed to the right, Democrats to the left. Solutions, fashioned somewhere in the middle, are a rarity because the two parties are so far apart. Explaining the screw-up over bad driver fees is particularly difficult for Republicans. Their ascendancy, beginning with George Allen's election as governor in 1993, rests on a talent for telling their story with a single word. No. No parole, no welfare, no gun control, no abortion, no car tax. The fee controversy requires more than the monosyllabic, and voters have neither the time nor patience for a long, winding defense of an idea on which many of them have already decided that their legislator and governor blew it. Maybe voters are thinking as Groucho did. Politics is the art of looking for trouble, finding it, misdiagnosing it, and then misapplying the wrong remedies.
Wonderful, wonderful piece. With lots of attitude, though, I think. Not strictly reporting. Tell me a little bit about your educational background and your career background.
I was graduated from a boys' school in New Jersey in the early 70s and then went on to university. I have a degree from Georgetown in history. I finished college in 1977 and shortly after finishing school moved to Louisiana, Lake Charles, Louisiana, on the Gulf Coast to work for a daily newspaper there, a PM newspaper, an afternoon newspaper. I was there for about a year and a half, and then I returned to the New York area. I'm from the city. To work on a suburban daily, what was then called a 24-hour newspaper. It published morning and afternoon editions. I was there for about 10 months, and then I moved to Richmond. That was October 1979, to the Richmond office of United Press International, one of the big news services. I was at UPI for 6 years, during which I moved to the Statehouse beat. That was late 1980, early 1981. And then in 1985, after the gubernatorial election, joined Virginia Business, which is a monthly magazine published by Media General, the company which publishes the Times-Dispatch. And for it, I covered government, politics, public policy, the legal profession. And then in April 1987, April 13th, the anniversary of Thomas Jefferson's birth, joined the Times-Dispatch.
And have been there since.
Where I have toiled since.
You've been here a long time, really making your adult life in Virginia. You must have known many colorful and interesting Virginia figures over the course of your career.
Oh, there have been many. There are many. I was particularly fortunate to hang out with those who were active on my side of the street, newspaper guys, as well as people who these newspaper guys covered, lobbyists, legislators, people who were active behind the scenes in politics and government here in Virginia. And some of them were quite colorful.
Who in particular? Yeah.
Well, Jim Latimer, who for many years was the political correspondent for the Times-Dispatch, remains a great hero for me. He covered government and politics for the paper for over four decades. Courtly Tennessean, tall, angular man with a great way about him. And it was on his watch that Virginia really began to change from this southern state, very focused on things like agriculture and segregation, into this big suburban state that is two-party competitive. Jim died about 7 or 8 years ago, and it's left a big hole. He was certainly of the old school, and I'm sure many of your listeners remember him.
And you paid tribute to him by writing his obituary, didn't you?
I did, and that was really an honor. He had been ill for some time, and I was assigned to write his obituary, and I think appropriately, on deadline. James H. Latimer, chronicler of Virginia's political history for the Richmond Times-Dispatch, during the state's wrenching transformation from quiet rural backwater preoccupied with segregation to booming southern dynamo, died yesterday at St. Mary's Hospital after a brief illness. He was 86. Mr. Latimer's career at the Times-Dispatch from 1937 to 1941 paralleled the rise and fall of the conservative Democratic machine of the late U.S. Senator Harry F. Byrd Sr., as well as a Republican ascendancy that commenced in the late 1960s. He covered the change in Virginia from the Old South to the New South and was respected by everyone involved, said Melville S. Buster Carrico, Mr. Latimer's competitor on the old Roanoke Times and World News. To contemporary journalists, Mr. Latimer, Lat, to colleagues and sources, might have seemed an anachronism. Courtly, modest, and contemplative, he was the consummate listener, at once comforting and intimidating the subjects of his reportage with long silences, followed by precise but elliptically phrased questions uttered in a voice that could be described only as lawyerly. Lat was always a very gentle person with all of his questionings, said former Governor Linwood Holton in 1969, the first Republican elected to the state's highest office. But I had a little problem once I was governor-elect. I was afraid I'd put my foot in my mouth, so I didn't talk with him. Well, I commiserated with him on it, and he said, "You're public property now." It helped me make the move from private citizen to public official. And in committing his story to words, Mr. Latimer didn't as much write when hunching his long bones, 6 foot, 2.5 inch frame over a typewriter as he did sculpt, once telling a friend that reporters ultimately composed for history. When he covered a story, he went over it like a vacuum cleaner. Every fact was there, said Guy Friedel, longtime columnist for the Virginian Pilot and political writer for the former Richmond News Leader. James Howe Latimer, a native of Nashville, Tennessee, grew up on Signal Mountain outside Chattanooga. He reported on 12 Virginia gubernatorial administrations, 16 national political conventions, and many sessions of the state's General Assembly. Except for several years on Tennessee papers, he spent his entire career with the Times-Dispatch. Widely honored, Mr. Latimer was the 1979 winner of the George Mason Award, given by the Richmond chapter of the Society of Professional Journalists for Outstanding Contributions to Virginia Journalism. He was a 1987 inductee into the Virginia Communications Hall of Fame. Outwardly laconic and serious, the horn-rimmed Mr. Latimer was not without his mischievous side. He was among a group of reporters, lobbyists, and government officials who played a permutation of gin rummy known as mullet, named for a fish renowned for its stupidity. The game was based on Virginia politics. The game, played for small stakes, operated for years from a cigarette-singed desk at the back of the Capitol press room and was broken up after newspaper reports depicting it as another example of the chummy, male-only nature of the statehouse scene. Mr. Latimer and his fellow mullets, as devotees of the game were known, moved the game off Capitol Square, meeting once or twice a year for an evening of revelry and reminiscence.
Lovely, lovely. And you can tell that you were a good friend. You have enjoyed a great deal of success yourself as a reporter and have gotten the attention of an international publication that you now write for. I'm talking about The Economist. Tell us a little bit about how that happened.
In the late 1980s, actually the early 1990s, Governor Wilder had taken office. It was very clear his ambitions were considerably higher. And as he was sending out some feelers as a prospective presidential candidate, I would travel around the country with the governor and often run into reporters for other news organizations, domestic as well as foreign. One of them was a correspondent in Washington for The Economist, a fellow by the name of Michael Elliott, who has since left the publication. And we crossed paths frequently, and I mentioned to him at one point that I think my words to him were, "You really should be thinking about writing a bit on Wilder," to which he said, "Why don't you do it?"
Oh.
And so the dots were connected, and in late 1980, early 1991, I contributed my first piece to The Economist, and I've been writing for the publication ever since.
Did you bring something from The Economist to read for us today?
I have several articles, actually. I have written about government and politics, and not just in Virginia, but across the South, and on issues other than government and politics. For example, this is a piece I wrote in spring, this past spring, about a proposed uranium mine in Virginia. This would be in Pennsylvania County down along the North Carolina border. One of the great challenges, and I use that word in a full and positive, fully positive sense, writing for an international audience, is making a point with color and economy. And this piece is entitled "Uranium Mining in Virginia's Glowing Hills." Plenty of uranium lies in the Piedmont. That's where many think it should stay. 30 years after America's worst atomic accident at the Three Mile Island plant in Pennsylvania, and 330 miles away in the rural Piedmont region of Virginia, a retired Army officer turned diplomat wants to kickstart the country's nuclear industry in his own front yard. Walter Coles and his son, also Walter, backed with $25 million from a clutch of unidentified local investors, Canadian energy firms, hedge funds, and equity shops, proposed to mine the largest untapped load of uranium in the United States. The problem is a Virginia law, largely the handiwork of environmentalists and some of Mr. Coles' frightened neighbors, which prohibits uranium mining anywhere in the state. Bands of the radioactive ore stretch north-south along Virginia's rolling hills. An estimated 119 million pounds lies beneath farm and timberland that has been the Coles family seat since the 1700s. Even with spot prices down to $40 a pound from $136 in June 2007, the uranium is worth billions. Profit is one inducement. So are friendly murmurings from the Obama White House about expanded nuclear power. By May, the Department of Energy is expected to announce an $18.5 billion loan guarantee for two or three new nuclear reactors. The Virginia uranium that might power those plants and America's 104 existing civilian reactors is off-limits because of a ban enacted by Virginia in 1982. That was the last time a mine and mill was proposed for Pennsylvania County, named after William Pitt the Elder, a vast former tobacco and textile area above the Virginia-North Carolina border. The Coles, father and son, are campaigning to have that moratorium lifted. At least $7,000 has been contributed to state lawmakers, and more could flow in Virginia's approaching elections. Five lobbying firms are busily at work, and an online effort to enlist support is underway. The mine, an idea that is at least 5 years from becoming reality, says the elder Mr. Coles, could generate 300 to 500 jobs in a region where unemployment is high. Danville, the area's biggest city, had a jobless rate in January of 16.8%. Opponents retort that the latest figures from the Energy Information Administration show that only 500 people are employed in uranium mining and milling nationwide. A uranium mine coupled with proposed oil and gas wells 50 miles off the state's Atlantic coast could put Virginia, already second to California, as an importer of electricity, according to the EIA, in the energy exporting business. Besides, a boost in domestic production could make America less dependent on dodgy foreign suppliers such as Russia and Kazakhstan. In 2007, Russia alone provided 33% of the uranium consumed by America. For the mine's opponents, however, the stakes are too high. They dismiss the claim that new technology allows the ore to be extracted with little harm to the environment. And approximately 200 miles east of Pennsylvania County, the cities of Virginia Beach and Chesapeake, with a combined population approaching 700,000, fear that runoff from a mine could poison their water supply. Suddenly, the fight over uranium mining is no longer between Mr. Coles and their neighbors.
Very interesting, and interesting to hear how a Virginia story sits in a world context. And to do it so quickly, that was really very nice.
Well, I have the good fortune of working for some great editors at The Economist. They are true wordsmiths, and even at great distance, compressed largely by email and the internet, I've been able to learn a great deal about making a point without using a lot of words.
We have time for one more piece. What would you like to read for us?
Gosh, well, here is a reminiscence about another political figure whom your listeners may remember, Hunter Andrews. This was a column that I wrote shortly after he died in 2005. I knew Hunter Andrews. Hunter Andrews was a friend of mine, and there will never be another Hunter Andrews. Hunter Booker Andrews died Thursday night at his home on Hampton's Chesapeake Avenue, the city's Gold Coast, overlooking the ship channel at Hampton Roads. Andrews, 83, apparently had a heart attack. For a fellow known for his remarkable energy, it was probably the best way to go, in a flash. Can anyone picture Hunter, it always came out Hunter, lingering in a hospital bed, unable to loudly spout the ideas and intrigues that were his stock in trade? Andrews, who came to dominate the Virginia Senate over a 32-year career that ended with his not all that surprising defeat in 1995, comfortably existed in the past, present, and future. That's a rare trait in anyone, rarer still in politicians who increasingly live for the next election. Andrews could tell you why the boundary between the cities of Hampton and Norfolk is on the Norfolk side of Hampton Roads, because during colonial times, when his people landed in Hampton, the border was determined by the whim of the crown. Andrews could explain how Virginia ranks against its sister states on school spending and other programs, because he was a member of the Education Commission of the States and the Executive Committee of the National Conference of State Legislatures. Andrews also could argue why it is important to occasionally raise taxes, because the sleepy, rural-oriented commonwealth in which he grew up is now the 12th largest state in the nation, a suburban dynamo in which people will demand more from government, not less. During debates in the red and gold-colored Senate chamber, where it seems he was never, ever photographed with his mouth closed by colleague Bob Brown, Andrews would refer to himself in the third person. A haughty flourish? Sure, but it was in keeping with the ancient traditions of a legislative body that traces its origins to the House of Lords, and which, Andrews often reminded his colleagues, endures long after a governor is gone. Ergo, Andrews was the humble little senator from Hampton. But there was nothing humble about him. Andrews, who simultaneously served as Democratic Majority Leader and Chairman of the Budget-Writing Senate Finance Committee, wore power comfortably, like a slightly frayed button-down shirt from his preferred haberdasher, Brooks Brothers. He directed billions in taxpayer dollars beyond his district, to the Metro Mass Transit System in Northern Virginia, to the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts in Richmond, of which his wife had been a trustee, to the Center for Innovative Technology near Washington Dulles International Airport, to a program encouraging new physicians to practice where they are scarce, in the countryside. That Andrews never became a governor or a U.S. senator he briefly tried for the latter in 1978, may have been rooted in his impatience with electoral politics. Andrews had the talent for high office, but couldn't come to terms with the fact that anointment went out with the Holy Roman Empire. Andrews could be absolutely impossible, given to high decibel rants in which he would literally spray a room with his anger after verbally disemboweling whoever incurred his wrath at the time. Just ask Paul Timmerick, a former Secretary of Finance, or Robert Lauterbergh, a budget and planning director, or Ed Mazur, the former state controller whose name Andrews would intentionally mispronounce in Mazur's presence. Andrews wasn't a heartless SOB. He just pretended to be one. When Andrews had coronary bypass surgery in 1985, it forced him to give up his cigarettes and cut back on his vodka, he joked that the doctor was surprised to find he even had a heart. The key to dealing with Andrews was simple. Be as aggressive with him as he was with everyone else. If Andrews thought he could push you around, he would. I remember being summoned to his office about 15 years ago. He was steamed, convinced the newspaper was ignoring him. Like all really good politicians, Andrews was a little bit paranoid. The off-the-record conversation quickly turned to his high-handed manner, his skill, and that's what it was, in being downright abusive. I told him his conduct at times was despicable, so bad that I considered complaining to his sturdy, easygoing wife, Cynthia. That got Andrew's attention. He turned bright red and sat bolt upright in his high back chair. Apparently, Andrew's ability to put about a bit of stick, maintaining discipline, may have been exceeded only by Cynthia's. And Andrews was a snob, but in a charming Faulknerian way, given to hanging out with people with last names for first names and prattling on about colorful, distant aunts, always pronounced aunts, and other quirky relations. Andrews also was a snob about Virginia. He recognized the state's history was not all glorious, that, for example, the stain of segregation lingers. Andrews took enormous pride in the peaceful integration of the Hampton public schools he and his children attended and that he helped oversee as a member of the local Board of Education. Hunter Andrews always wanted Virginia to be better, and if that required he be a cantankerous pain in the patootie, so be it.
I loved that. You liked Hunter Andrews, didn't you?
Oh, he was quite the character.
I love the idea of going to his wife to get him in line. A little bit about you, personally. You are married?
I am.
And have a child?
My wife and I have a son who is almost 16 and a half.
And who will be looking at college soon.
We have commenced that process.
Well, good luck.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Jeff Shapiro today on The Writer's Voice. Jeff is a reporter and a columnist for the Richmond Times-Dispatch, and he also writes for The Economist. Thanks for joining us. I'm Patty Campbell for The Virginia Voice.
You've been listening to The Writer's Voice. Listen online or download to your computer or MP3 player at www.virginiavoice.org. Virginia Voice. Connect by listening.